Chez, 4 o'clock, another one directed by Jill Westerby, and the 12th, another one, actually on 8 p.m., directed by Megan Kate Ward. And for more info, go to thehearthcollective.com or PCS blog. That's it for Stage and Studio. Thank you to engineer Janet Anderson. Check us out at stageandstudio.org, where I'll have photos and the podcast of this. And check me out on facebook.com/stage_and_studio. Till next time, I'm Dee Mae Roberts. We're going to go out with another song from Conduits Dance Plus from LED.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to present The Harder They Come as part of the KBOO at the Clinton monthly film series. The Harder They Come is a 1972 Jamaican crime film. With dreams of becoming a successful reggae singer, a young Jamaican man, played by Jimmy Cliff, finds corruption from his record producers and the drug pushers they're connected to. Again, that's The Harder They Come, Thursday, July the 9th at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Tucci Ristorante, an Italian dining house honoring the memory of Mary Cipolla Matucci and the spirit of the Lido restaurant in which she worked for 50 years. Tucci Ristorante features sustainable Northwest ingredients, drinks in the Lido bar, and is open every day in downtown Lake Oswego. Information at tucci.biz. That's TUCCI.BIZ.
Welcome to the Catskill Review of Books, a weekly program interviewing authors, hosted by Ian Williams and produced by Kevin Greff in the hydro-powered studios of WJFF in Jeffersonville, New York.
Hello, this is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books again. And this week I am talking to Bill Hoagland, William Hoagland, and his book, Founding Finance, How Debt, Speculation, Foreclosures, Protests, and Crackdowns Made Us a Nation. Bill started, as I'm right, his authorial career writing about the Whiskey Rebellion and has been sort of drifting towards sobriety ever since in considering deeper fiscal matters. The last book we discussed was about how the Declaration of Independence was crafted in a military coup almost. Well, it was a military coup in Pennsylvania. So, Bill, what impelled you to write this book, which so obviously has echoes with the season upon us now?
Well, it's a really kind of a culmination of the work I did and the two books, in working on and researching the two books you were just talking about. I mean, the Whiskey Rebellion is called the Whiskey Rebellion because Alexander Hamilton named it that, and we've called it that ever since, and it makes a good title for a book, so I retained it. But actually, it was not really a rebellion over whiskey per se. It was a rebellion over regressive finance policies of the federal government and a class conflict over how best and how most appropriately in a Republican government to structure the relationship between finance and government. And in Declaration, from another tack, I found that I was writing about a populist movement to attempt to take over Republican government during the year 1776. And in Pennsylvania, they actually did, a populist democratic movement of the kind that many historians claim is anachronistic to even talk about in 1776. But they knew what they were doing, and they said what they were doing. And again, that movement had much to do with money, with finance, with class issues around how government, how a representative government should best, or how it horribly goes wrong in coping with matters of finance, public finance, private finance, lending, speculation, banking, all the stuff that indeed we are extremely fraught about today.
Well, of course, it couldn't be. It'd be difficult to get anything further from the Tea Party vision of what the Founding Fathers were all about, wouldn't it? So you have a bunch of radicals on the one hand who wanted distributed government, and on the other hand, you have this cabal, I think, almost around Hamilton and Morris, who are trying to redesign an America based upon a big national debt, regular payments to bondholders, and it makes you want to give three cheers for Aaron Burr for shooting Hamilton, doesn't it?
Yeah, the Tea Party view of the Tea Party view of that period. I do my best in Founding Finance to show as I think insupportable in every possible way. You know, it's interesting that the Tea Party has brought up these finance issues again, where actually some sort of liberal history has been at some pains to bury them under kind of a big load of, to me, false consensus. But in bringing up these issues, the Tea Party, I think, gets it really largely backwards what was going on regarding finance. You know, they make a huge hero, of course, of all. They sort of don't distinguish among any of, quote unquote, the founders. So that George Washington is their big hero, one of their big heroes. And really, I think, and I go to some length to show this in the book, I think had Washington been president and their movement been active, he would have had no compunction about rounding them up and putting them in jail. But that's not how they want to see it. So I think their imagination is, as you put it, a bit fevered around these issues. But that's not to say that they're not worth talking about. And what's interesting, another feature of the research I've done suggests to me that that some of the liberal historians have been at some pains as well to kind of deny the centrality of these kinds of conflicts in the founding.
Well, it's always struck me as an outsider to see the reverence with which the Constitution is invoked and evoked by both left and right, when obviously they mean different things by it. And, of course, you know, it makes it an interesting document, you know, that they can both invoke it to mean the opposite.
Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, as if it could only mean one thing, and that what it means must be the thing you believe in. And then you can use it as a stick to beat your opponent over the head. As if, you know, anytime you invoke the Constitution, you're basically saying the argument's over, you know, I've won. But it never works, of course, because the other side has just as much access to the document and to that same tactic. And I don't know about other countries, really, to what extent they do the same thing, but it seems to me a peculiarly American tendency to want to refer to, you know, it's like referring to scripture in a sense, and assuming that once having referred to it, your argument is just made, you know.
Well, I think there's probably only 80 actually has such a reverence for the Constitution that they keep on doing silly things like refusing to allow a president who hasn't been able to hold his office to take up another term of office because the Constitution says so. You know, most of the rest of the world is a lot more pragmatic, and that's the whole point, I think, from looking at it. The Constitution, far from being tablets of stone brought down from the mountain, was in fact a sort of atypical American political horse trade between different parties.
Yeah, the realpolitik of the creation of the Constitution, again, I think has much to do, much, much more than most of our most influential historians ever want to discuss, has much to do with again, this issue of public finance and of trying to push back very, very strenuously against a more democratic approach to finance, which, though it was in the 18th century, is not unfamiliar to us today, actually, a more egalitarian approach. And the Constitution was framed in the context when Edmund Randolph kicked off the proceedings at the Constitutional Convention. You know, he didn't make any bones about it. The famous founders themselves. Sometimes it sounds like I'm talking about some sort of like secret history of the founding or something. And you know, it feels that way because it's secret to us. We somehow kept it secret to ourselves, but. But the founders themselves didn't see it that way. I mean, Randolph said, "What we are here to do is redress the excesses of democracy in this country." And he was speaking in a very specifically economic and financial context that everyone in the room there would have clearly understood. The funny thing is that we don't understand it.
Well, that's the interesting bit. You talk about the secret history. Of course, you know, you do. I, by the way, noticed that you have thanked me right at the end of the, along with a list of other people, because when I was writing about the history of rum, I discovered the same thing, that none of this was a secret in the history books. It's just that somehow it was, it never sort of rose through the ice. It was kept submerged all of the time, so it never got into the popular consciousness. And part of that is because, of course, if you think that the founding fathers were a bunch of slave trading, rum drinking, tax dodging speculators, it sort of does not resonate with the iconography that we operate as a country on.
No, and if you're constantly making appeals politically in terms of modern politics, and you know, throughout this election season, I mean, everybody does it. Political arguments are not made sort of on their merits as, would this be a good policy, or is this a good idea, or what do we want to do here? They're so frequently made in this country on the basis of, well, this fulfills the predictions, the desires, the wants of the founders. And if you're constantly in a state of having to make elemental claims on the very basic values by which we were formed to make your political point, you're not going to be interested. In fact, you'll be very interested in suppressing any realistic discussion of the politics of the period. And while it's true that certainly is true on the side of popular history, I mean, most of the popular histories that are published tend to ignore everything I'm talking about. It's, I think, partly also been an effort of the scholarly profession over the past 50 to 60 years or so to make sure that these issues don't really leak into popular consciousness. A lot of what I'm doing in the book, I am talking about finance in the founding period and conflicts over finance in the founding period as central to the emergence of the country. But I'm also at the same time doing a fairly thoroughgoing critique of all of the most sort of certified and influential historians of the past, you know, half century at least.
Well, I was going to mention that you sort of break into historiography in the middle of the book, and you discuss the way that these renowned historians like McCullough just basically ignore plain facts in front of their nose. And you can't help thinking whether this is a genuine Orwellian process of doublethink, is that basically what we're doing, you're doing in particular, is asking them to think the unthinkable, and they just can't bring themselves to do it.
Yeah, I can't figure it out. I mean, I know that in the academic profession, you can. I don't get into too much about this in the book, but I do mention it, and it's a huge factor. I think in the academic profession, I think the Cold War played an enormous role in just redirecting what could and could not be discussed, and there were just younger historians of that generation became very interested in pushing back against the progressive historians that had preceded them, and developed a new consensus history that suggested that the United States had always been kind of in a very consistent, very, you know, broadly middle class, broadly democratic way, the United States that they wanted to sort of posit as elementally opposed to you know, Soviet communism. I think you can actually trace that in the academic world. It's not so much a, you know, a secret or a conspiracy theory as something that just, you know, it was a natural tendency, and I think a lot of historians ran with it and built fairly big careers on it at the time. But then when you get, I mean, but since, as you've just said, I mean, just since the same thing with rum, I mean, this stuff is lying around in plain sight, actually, when you start really looking at it from a slightly different angle. I can't figure out the reason why there's such a desire, and such an effective desire to deny certain plain facts while overemphasizing, you know, others and so forth, like where the impulse for that really comes from. But it does seem to me to be like what you're saying, like just... Is it double think? Is it how conscious is it? I don't know.
This is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books, and I'm talking to William Hoagland about his book Founding Finance: How Debt, Speculation, Foreclosures, Protests, and Crackdowns Made Us a Nation. And a recent example, I presume you saw the Smithsonian excavation of Monticello and Jefferson's books, where historians in the 50s and 60s deliberately, once again, maybe they did it unconsciously, but they left out from all of the collected documents the sort of the logbooks for the floggings of the slaves that he ordered. And his comments on the slaves, on how you got a better rate of return from owning slaves, from natural increase from having slave children you could sell, than you would from investing money in government bonds.
Yeah, this just came to my attention recently through the new book that really lays this all out, Master of the Mountain, I believe it's called. And it's, I think I'm beyond being shocked by the degree to which the sort of the consensus mode works to try to just to numb out certain glaring, really horribly painful facts. And yet this information, when it came to my attention, and I haven't run it down to the ground, but it once again shocked me. I mean, to what degree is a historian sitting in a room consciously just, waiting out what happened? And to what degree is this process an unconscious one? And to what end? I mean, I think we can see what some of the ends are. If you're lionizing a certain figure, you definitely want to make sure that there's nothing hanging around that would seek to undermine that. But as a historical process, it seems just sort of, it still has the capacity to shock me after all of this.
Well, one of the points about this is, if you have a national iconography in which the shared figures are the founding fathers, then the purpose of a left-wing historian is to claim them for liberalism and the left, and for right-wing, a conservative historian, to claim them for the conservatives. So we saw this. Christopher Hitchens' lionization of Jefferson hardly fits in with the slave logbooks that came out a few months after Hitchens died.
Yeah, and this keeps happening with Jefferson. I mean, it just amazes me that the New Deal era, and this came straight, I believe, largely anyway, from FDR himself, was just obsessed with the idea of sort of casting himself as a new Jefferson. But you have to do a lot of work on Jefferson to flip him around, to make him an advocate of, that kind of activist New Deal type government. And partly, it seems to me, it was because the right wing, sort of the conservative business community of the period had already appropriated Hamilton, although Hamilton was anything but a non-activist of government when it came to business. And so there are always these sort of almost absurd, I mean, actually literally absurd contradictions, which when you're just talking about them from a history point of view, they're interesting and they're ironic and they say something about what history is and how it works. But it's really amazing when they get built into our entire way of thinking about current politics so that we almost can't think outside them. They have a potentially kind of destructive capacity.
Well, taking your book, which I've just finished reading, it reminded me, but once again, it'd be shocking to a lot of people, that those famous Minutemen and others who fought the American Revolution were bilked of almost all of their pay. They were paid in worthless bonds, which were snapped up by speculators, whereas their officers were rewarded with large amounts of bonds, which were honored in full, in return, of course, for suppressing the mutiny and making sure that the disbanded soldiers went home afterwards. So,
the idea that that the revolutionary legacy for the huge majority of people who fought in that war, it's frequently emphasized, and it's not untrue that many of the famous leaders made certain sacrifices, and people are always very eager to underscore the sacrifices made by George Washington, the financial sacrifices and the personal sacrifices. And far be it from me to try to deny that. It's just fascinating to me that that's always where the spotlight goes, that it just sort of almost seems to go there inexorably, no matter what you say or do. Whereas if you turn the spotlight around a little bit and look at the enormous numbers of ordinary people, the men who fought in that war, imagine the countryside filling up after the war is over with, just thousands and thousands and thousands of broke, disappointed veterans of a hard war. I mean, why wouldn't we want to look at that, since it seems quite resonant to me, nowadays, with some of the same conflicts that we're struggling over today? And yet it's true, and what you just said is so true, that both sides, left, right, liberal or conservative, whatever we want to call them in American politics today, will always tend to want to look at Washington and claim him as their own. And actually, it doesn't really matter on some level then who's right and who's wrong, and whether Washington's sacrifices are more aptly applied to a liberal policy or conservative policy. The thing that kind of blows my mind is that we're always wanting to look at the big figures and not just look at them, but look away from the immense difficulties and the you know, horrible, painful conflicts involved in what happened to ordinary people at that time.
This is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books, and I'm talking to William Hoagland about his book Founding Finance. Incidentally, I'm part of this since I'm actually doing some research on the Loyalists at the moment. If these people definitely fought on the wrong side. The people who fought with the British and the Loyalists were actually given land grants and large resettlement grants to move to Canada. The British looked after the people, the so-called traitors, far better than the Congress looked after the patriots, it would appear.
That's just painfully ironic and so interesting because, you know, one of the groups I talk about in Founding Finance, the North Carolina Regulators, who were an earlier uprising, I try to emphasize it was an uprising against American privilege, not against British influence in the early 1760s, really. Many of the North Carolina Regulators who had a very egalitarian viewpoint and deeply mistrustful of American elites, the very American elites who became the American revolutionaries in the 1760s and 1770s. Well, a number of those radical North Carolina regulators just wouldn't go along with the American Revolution, really, when it finally came around to that. They saw it as, you know, a rich men's revolution against, you know, other rich men, and they believed they would get a better shake as poorer people from the English government. Some others who were in that regulation, like Herman Husband, did not see it that way. They were under the impression that the Stamp Act protests were sort of in line with the regulation, with the radicalism of the regulation. But Husband found out throughout the course of his, you know, ultimately fairly tragic life that such was not the case.
Yeah, that's one of the things you bring out very well, I think, is the fact that you had these two disparate groups of people, the ones who later fought the Whiskey Rebellion and Shays Rebellion, and the sort of elite revolutionaries, and they all thought somehow that they were fighting for the same thing when it was clear that they were not. And once again, it seems, you know, that the idea of lambs voting for the abattoir in the current election cycle, where people who are poor and downtrodden and paying no and are quite happy to vote and shout for lower taxation on people who are screwing them into the ground.
Yeah, it's a you know, when you think you're on the same side, I think it may be I guess what I'm trying to get at in the book is partly that I think it's sort of a founding pattern for people to need to believe they're on the same side when many, many things, you know, if you could see fully, if you had the 360-degree, you know, could look the whole thing, look over the whole circle, you would see that it couldn't be the case. I mean, one of the most painful, poignant stories, I think, is of Thomas Paine, who continued to believe long after it was overwhelmingly obvious to probably literally everybody else, and Paine was anything but an idiot, that George Washington and he were really on the same side. I mean, he referred to it in a letter to Washington as their shared ardor of 1776. He was talking about the French Revolution, and Washington was out to, you know, demolish all such egalitarian uprisings at home and abroad. But Paine just couldn't see it until he was in jail in France, and the U.S. government turned its back on him. And then, of course, he saw it all at once. And it, you know, it really killed him, I think. Basically, I think it almost literally did kill him. He was broken after that because he couldn't see it until then he saw it all at once and took it as an immense personal betrayal. Yeah, and yet people still to this day, I mean, you will still find people on the left in this country quoting John Adams and saying, you know, Adams and Jefferson, for example, always believed in the freedom of speech, you know, no matter what the situation. And it's manifestly untrue of Adams. And actually, if you wanted to go there, it would in many ways it's untrue of Jefferson too. But the sort of left claims on those figures are kind of an alternative to having to claim people like Paine in prison in France, which is not a very edifying picture, or Herman Husband leading, you know, influencing the Whiskey Rebels to rise up against the federal government. I mean, these are much less easy heroes to adopt as heroes. And so there's always this fight over the famous few, you know, the famous, the people on the money and others like John Adams. I like it.
You know, in Britain, it's evolved. Here, it's fossilized. The purpose of politics is to seize the treasury. That was the classic definition of 18th century British politics. The purpose was to seize the treasury and reward your supporters. And, I mean, that's basically sums up American politics for me.
Yeah, and it's true, but it's fossilized here. It hasn't developed, you know. It's And, you know, it's what's funny is that people who don't like what's going on politically today, and, you know, nobody does, whatever side they're on, think it's whatever's bad is a departure from some
glorious golden age.
Past. And if you just really look at the past, all of this same stuff was going on and, in fact, caused everything we're dealing with today. And maybe we could even fix it a little bit if we would just stop pretending there was a glorious past that we need to get.
Well, another thing I'd forgotten, which you brought up, was the fact that John Yoo, to justify detention without trial and executive orders and presidential authority to truncate human rights, invoked Washington in the Whiskey Rebellion.
Say in the book is that Yoo is not wrong there. You know, the sort of the quick liberal reaction would be to say, oh, that's preposterous. You know, that's John Yoo making a horrible right wing claim on the great Washington, the great Republican, you know, the Cincinnatus, the founding Cincinnatus. But in fact, you know, Yoo does get, in the most, you know, brutal realpolitik way, exactly what Washington was up to there. And the response to that, the sort of liberal response to that, really just legitimately can't be, oh, that's preposterous. I mean, it's harder to look at what Washington was actually doing and then still mount an argument against what Yoo is saying, because then you'd have to abandon certain aspects, not all aspects, but certain aspects of the career of George Washington, or dissent from that career in certain ways. And I think that's very hard politically for Americans engaged in dire conflict about their history, you know, to do.
Well, of course, the other irony there was what Washington, you point out, that in fact it was acts of terrorism. They were burning down courthouses and tarring and feathering tax gatherers and refusing to accept lawful authority. And, of course, the big irony for those of us who look at 1776 is this was exactly what was happening in Boston when the British sent in troops as well. So Washington, by what he was doing, was in effect legitimating King George III retrospectively.
Yeah. I mean, Samuel Adams is another great example there, because, you know, of course, Samuel Adams, so associated with many of those uprisings in Boston and with bringing about independence, you know, in Philadelphia by taking down aiding and abetting in the taking down of Pennsylvania's elected government and so forth. But the second that was over, his position was, well, now it's a republic. Now we have a republic. And so, therefore, any acts against the state of any kind of rioting, should be punishable by death, because, you know, we've won. We have it now. The fact that in Massachusetts the Constitution was carefully written to rule out many people voting unless they had sufficient property and so forth didn't play for him. He and the people he had made common cause with were not after the same things. But he wanted the death penalty for the Shays rebels in Massachusetts. And I, as I say in the book, anyone who thought that was a turnaround on Samuel Adams' part really had never understood Samuel Adams to begin with.
Where he was coming from to begin with, yes. But what about Alexander Hamilton? You present him in a fairly ambiguous light here. On the one hand, I mean, you don't accuse him of cleaning up and doing all of this for self-interest. He was a sort of dirigist with an overarching vision of an industrialized America based upon... he was almost an Ayn Randian figure using the government, wasn't he?
I've written a lot about Hamilton in so many contexts. And in this book, I found, you know, I just want to make sure that it's so easy once you start looking at certain things Hamilton did politically and financially to sort of line up against him. And certainly there are many reasons why that would make a lot of sense. There's an immediate sort of desire to hitch your wagon to the star of James Madison as an alternative to Hamilton then, trying to make him a liberal hero over and against what appears to be, what really was Hamilton's regressiveness. And so I'm trying to present Hamilton in this book in a little bit more of a, you know, I definitely do not accuse him, and I don't think anyone ever successfully has accused Hamilton of doing everything he did simply to enrich himself.
No, you accuse him of being regressive. So, you know, if you read the Communist Manifesto and Marx's and Engels' hymn of praise to the developments of capitalism and how it would change the world and the landscape, you could regard him as being on the vanguard of history. I mean, what he was pushing for was...
Now this is going to develop, and out of this, the new conflicts will arise. And, you know, I don't tend to see things as quite that neat, but it's true that in many ways, of course, he was a liberal and a progressive. A lot of liberals and progressives today who don't like Hamilton's policies don't like to think of him that way. But over and against the kind of, you know, entrenched, more aristocratical approach of some of the great Southern gentlemen, the squires like Jefferson and Madison and so forth, he was an urbanist and an industrial type and really was looking to the future. And that makes him quite interesting. And I think it was a vision very much connected to Robert Morris's vision. A vision of a future America that, you know, the Hamiltonians always say, you know, he was the one, he saw the future. I would say to a great extent that's true, but then you might want to question, you know, how well that future is working out for the mass.
This was William Hoagland with Founding Finance, how debt, speculation, foreclosures, protests, and crackdowns made as a nation.
The Catskill Review of Books from WJFF in Jeffersonville, New York.
Attention KABU members and listeners. The KABU Foundation is seeking to fill four upcoming vacancies on the Board of Directors. Terms run 3 years, beginning on October 1st. The nomination packet, due July 11th, is posted on the KABU website and paper copies are available at the station. Candidates must submit the completed nomination packet via email to kabucommunity@gmail.com or mail or drop off the completed nomination packet, care of Timothy Welp, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Incomplete forms will not be considered as fulfilling the statement of interest requirement by the KABU bylaws. Packets are due by Saturday, July 11th. The candidate statements submitted as part of the nomination packet will be posted to KABU's website, and candidates will be expected to participate in an interview for broadcast and a Q&A session at the annual meeting. For more information, please contact the nominating committee